The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Amateur Traveler, episode 827. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about wildebeest and zebra, lions and leopards, bee eaters and pratincoles as we go on safari in Tanzania. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about Tanzania. I'd like to welcome to the show Jane Horlings from Capistrano Beach, California. Also, you can find her on Instagram at bioprof. But Jane has come to talk to us not about Capistrano Beach, but about Tanzania. Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And what's your connection with Tanzania?
We went this last summer of 2022 for the second time. We had gone about 9 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we've been on several safaris since, but we wanted to return to a country that we wanted to visit some of the same places. And then there's so much new to explore. And we did a little exploring in new parks on this trip as well. Okay.
And when you say parks, we're going to do, this is going to be about a safari type trip, or a safari type of vacation, which is how many people are experiencing Tanzania. If you go way, way back in the archives to the first year of Amateur Traveler, you can find a trip that I did that it's in two parts, two episodes, one that's more of a volunteer trip and one that's more of the parks. And we've done several other safari type experiences in Tanzania since. But it was time to do it again.
So. Absolutely. And this wasn't a COVID postponed trip. It was a, after the worst of COVID passed and people were traveling a lot more, we want to get back at it. And we wanted specifically to see the wildebeest migration again in the Serengeti.
And I think that starts to answer the question of why should someone go to Tanzania?
Oh my, it's the animals. I'm a biology professor, retired mm-hmm. now. So for me, vacations are often about the wildlife and the scenery. And this never disappoints. There's animals big and small that you see all of the day when you're out mm-hmm. on safari.
When you talk about the wildebeest migration, you were there for what we call the Great Migration, which happens a couple times a year. And I don't remember exactly what times a year it happens. When was your trip?
We were there in August, and okay. they were migrating generally north. But what happens is you have this huge population of wildebeest, mm-hmm. along with some zebras, and as is correctly pronounced, what we call zebras. And the two species intermingle, and they move generally north. And then at the other time of year, they move to the south. But what happens is that you have these huge herds, they're milling around, and then one or two of them gets the wild idea to go back across the river, which, by the way, has crocodiles in it. And they're basically cows mm-hmm. in a different body. But so they all follow the other way, and then they graze over there for a day. And then again, one or two gets this wild idea to go back across the river. And so it's this back and forth that you see over a 2 month time. So you're never going to miss it if you're there mm-hmm. In that season. It's not like it happened yesterday and you've missed it. It goes on all day for quite a while. And so you see these crossings at different points, which mm-hmm. the guides know these specific points where they tend to cross, and they radio each other so that you can make a mad dash to a certain point to see them crossing.
So you're saying it's not a sprint. They're not racing from Tanzania up into Kenya or whatever, but migrating their way slowly as they graze.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of back and forth, which to me seems pointless because there's crocodiles in the river, it would seem to me, once you get across.
Seems like a bad idea,
You should just stay across, but it's just not what happens. And I honestly don't exactly know why.
Yeah, that is my relationship to crocodiles, is to avoid them as much as possible.
But, absolutely.
I
and
love seeing them
huge
from a distance.
Yep.
Now, you did three parks on this trip. So when we talk about your itinerary, we're going to be park-centric. And you did which three, and I say parks. So assuming they were parks, but that isn't always the case in Tanzania. They're also private conservation areas. And I don't know which you went to.
These were national parks. So first we were in the Serengeti, and we chose to stay there a little. Often you stay 3 days at a camp, and we stayed four just to see more. Mm-hmm. And then we flew. It is, of course, more expensive, but more expeditious with your time if you can fly from camp to camp. So we then flew to the Ruaha, which was very different. And we went to two camps there and drove between the two. And then we flew to the last camp, which the old name for it is Selou, S-E-L-O-U-S, which is the name of a big game hunter from there. And so the name has been changed officially now to Nyerere, which is, I think, the name of the first president of the country. So they're taking the name away from a hunter. So one of the things that you see different is the parks are different in their environment. And also in the Serengeti, there has not been hunting for a long time, decades and decades.
Right.
So except for the elephants, none of the animals remembers that we humans could bear guns to kill them. So in the Serengeti, you have much less fear in the animals of humans who approach in vehicles. In both the Ruaha and the Nyerere parks, there is hunting. In the Selou, there's still hunting in the south, which of course a lot of us have opinions about, but you cannot get that close to the animals. We were probably 3, 4, 5 times distant to the animals there. And the same in the Selou. But yet, there's 1/100th of the people in the Ruaha compared to the Serengeti, which is really overcrowded right now. And so being in a very desolate area and having to work harder to see the animals, to me, really has its benefits.
Okay. Let's start at the beginning. Let's start in Serengeti. So you flew in, I assume, to Arusha, to Kilimanjaro Airport?
Yes. And that's the hub for the safari. It's also, interestingly, where most of the guides get their education. Arusha has the guide training, I guess you'd call them colleges. You find guides in that country that are so well-trained, and they spend their break time poring over the nature books, the bird books. They really know their stuff, which is important for people like me who really want to see the odd birds, not just see the big mammals. It's wonderful to have such well-trained guides and guides who really have a passion for the animals.
We're going to get into the birds later because I do want to get into that with you. But you headed off then to Serengeti. So you drove there, I'm assuming, from Arusha.
We flew from Arusha.
Oh, you flew from Arusha. Okay, got it.
We flew from Arusha.
Definitely saving your time.
Yes. And then you get picked up at the airport and you generally go on a wildlife game drive on your way to your camp, which may be an hour away. The roads are, you have to go slow and plus you want to see things as you get there. And so the next day, the first full day, you're at it. You get up early, meaning like 6 o'clock. I am a small person. I bundle up. I wear layers upon layers because you're in often an open vehicle and it is chilly.
It's surprisingly cold. Yep.
It may be in the 40s and 50s. So I bundle up, and by the as the day goes on, you just shed your jacket, your sweatshirts, and it does get warm as the sun comes up. And we tended to go out in the morning and then take our breakfast with us. You can have a cup of coffee over the fire before you leave, but we like to get going and see as much as we can. So we often eat breakfast out in the bush, spread out on the front of the truck, which is fun. And of course, you only have breakfast and get out of the vehicle when you look around and you only see herbivores. If you see lots and lots of antelope, that means that there isn't lion prowling in the edges of the area.
And preferably when you can see a distance. Don't park under a big tree with a leopard into it. And then,
oh my gosh, and the guides will always, if you need to check the tires, as they sometimes say, or water the flowers, as others say, they'll stop by a big tree or a huge termite mound, and the guides will always go check behind it before you go behind it.
Right.
Then after a good long morning of game viewing, you'll come back and have lunch, and then maybe take a nap, read a book, wander around camp. You can't certainly wander far. You can't just go take a stroll because, of course, you're surrounded by wildlife and things that could potentially eat you.
When you're in the vehicle, you apparently don't look like food, which they tell you. And when you're first on your first safari, you hope they are telling you the truth. But it seems to be the case.
It's a very interesting feeling. We were at a kill on another safari in a different country. And we were with our good friends, and it was their first safari. And as these lions are tearing apart a Cape buffalo and going for the soft underside, my friend leaned over and whispered to me, "Why don't they just come and eat us?" And I said, "They just don't. We're in a vehicle. We are not seen as something to snack on.
We're not recognizable to them as food. But if you get out of the vehicle, you start getting a little more recognizable.
Absolutely.
That might be tasty." Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and you mentioned watering the tire, checking the tires, which is exactly the phrase that I've had multiple guides use. When we're in the Serengeti, I think this is one place of the three parks you've been to where many of us have a mental image of the savanna. And we're not staying at a lodge. And you don't just pull back to the lodge and use the flush toilets. You're out in the bush the whole time, including the camp, although the camp is sophisticated bush at this point.
Yes. Isn't it interesting? You're in the savanna. You see these sunsets with maybe an elephant silhouetted from your camp. You're surrounded by this nature and beauty. But in the camp, we were in a tented camp. The tents are set up for you with a bed and a nightstand. And we did have flush toilets.
Okay.
But when you want to take a shower, or when you come back to camp after the afternoon drive, they'll say, "Do you want to take a shower?" And my husband and I often say, "We'll just get one." Not that we're taking the shower together, which would be hard given the water pressure, but we only use about half the water. So they will bring hot water and they hoist it up with a pulley system. So it's over your shower stall, and then you turn on the water and out comes perfect temperature water for your shower. But wanting to save water out where you are, you'll wet yourself, turn the shower off, shower yourself up, wash your hair, whatever, turn the water back on. So it's a bucket shower, but it really doesn't feel that different from home if you were really conserving water. It comes out with decent pressure, and you can get more water if you want. But some of these camps are mobile, meaning they move with the wildebeest. So they go up north of the river, then they go south. And so the camps are set up so that they're not plumbed with plumbing and such. So it's an odd mix of roughing it, yet being treated so well. In the nighttime, when you go back to your bed, some camps will put a hot water bottle in your bed because it's chilly. Just these little treats are very special. But in many ways, you are roughing it and getting dirty and not really caring. It's a neat thing. Adult glamping, so to speak.
And excellent. And in the Serengeti, you're seeing wildebeest and zebras. And what other animals are we seeing? And then we'll get to the birds.
Oh my gosh. We really saw it all except for rhinos. If you were keeping track of the ones that people want to see, we did not see rhinos on this trip, nor did I really mind. I love seeing it all. We did see leopards, which aren't as common in the Serengeti. And we had some really neat sightings of leopards. We saw a fair number of cheetahs. And when I say fair number, like twice or maybe three times in those 3 days. Lots of birds. We had a neat sighting of elephants on our last day where they took our vehicle with our guide and just my husband and I. And the elephants walked up towards us, keeping an eye on us. The matriarchs were definitely giving us the once over.
Sure.
And then some of the elephants went right in front of the Jeep. Some went right behind. And then they just slowly walked off. And the sound you hear, besides just them rustling through the grass, is with their trunk, they grab a hunk of grass, rip it, and stuff it in their mouth. That's how they move. They just swipe the grass, rip it, stuff it in their mouth. Swipe the grass. So you hear this sound of ripping and chewing, and just they're moving through grass. They're surprisingly quiet.
Yeah.
It was just such a magic moment to be so close to these animals.
Mm-hmm.
And out in the wild. Let's see, what else did we see?
Yeah, I understand why the farmers aren't such big elephant fans, because you see the landscape with the twisted trees and broken things down, and a herd of elephants can make an impact on a landscape. But they're such magnificent animals. And when you get to sit 10 feet away from one, it's a pretty amazing experience.
Absolutely. We saw giraffes. We saw vultures. We saw crocodiles. We saw some large birds, not quite as large as an ostrich, called bustards. We did see lions. In fact, a lion came so close to our vehicle. And it was on the side of my husband. I stood up to take a picture of it. And it came to the back of our vehicle. And you know how cats rub on something to mark with the corner of their mouth? Lion did that on the back of our vehicle. And I stood up to take a picture of it. And our guide just hissed at me, "Sit down." Because by standing up, I become not part of this Jeep sort of thing. I might appear to be a tasty morsel of some sort, but it just walked right along the vehicle. It was crazy how close we were to it. If you had no sense, you would reach out and ruffle its mane. Obviously, you do not do that.
Yeah, and a few tourists do that every year or try to do that, and we don't want to talk about how that ends, but not well.
I know. We did get a picture of it from people in another Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
They took a picture facing us, so you can see this lion and my husband sitting with his hands in his lap, looking over his shoulder at this lion who was 8 inches from his thigh. A crazy experience. It shows how the animals just view us as like this noisy thing in their environment that they just ignore us. And quite honestly, sometimes they come near the vehicles just for shade.
When we were in Ngorongoro Crater in Tanzania, we came across a vehicle. It's a relatively smaller space than Serengeti. And a lot of the vehicles are in one area because they know that's where the lions will be. And we came across this vehicle that a lion was taking a nap with its paws holding the tire of the vehicle. And the people in the vehicle are, "We've been here for 45 minutes. We really need to go. I really need to go pee." But we have to wait for this lion to finish the nap because basically the lion has the right of way. So
You bet.
At some point, they'll probably start the engine and see if they can discourage the lion. But generally, they were going to wait it out.
Yes. We saw baboons. We saw some of these darling little bitty antelopes, like the dick. And we saw geckos. We saw these ants that I'll probably butcher the name. They call them belly ants.
Okay.
They're like warrior ants. We were in the vehicle and I took a picture from up above. I wasn't going to put my foot on the ground near these things. They were named after a warrior tribe from Namibia.
Okay.
And these ants, they were frightening from standing above them in the Jeep. From big to small, you see so much and so many interesting types of wildlife. It's an experience that just can't be beat.
And you mentioned birds and being not necessarily, I don't know if you'd consider yourself a birder or not, but a biology professor, you have a soft spot for birds as well as mammals.
Oh, absolutely. I keep a life list for what that's worth.
Okay. And I think that officially puts you in the birder camp then at that point. Once you have the list.
I just don't have a camera with a 2.5-foot lens.
There we go.
But I do keep a list of how many I saw, and I think it was around 160 different kinds of birds on this trip. Now, the guides go out of their way to point things out to me because they know that I love to see the birds and they knew that I was counting. But there's so many fascinating little tiny birds and big birds, seeing the vultures and how they behave. A friend of mine had told me before my first safari, she'd been on a couple. She said, "You'll never be bored if you're interested in birds." Because there's always birds to be seen. Even if you're just surrounded by antelope and nothing's happening, there'll always be birds around to take a look at.
Any new favorites after your trip?
When we were in the Ruaha, there was this cheeky little bird that kind of reminded me of the meadowlark from the Midwest. And it looked a little different, but the body was the same. And it had this way of getting irritated with you when you were close to where its nest was. And it would fly up in the air and flutter down and scream at you. And its name was the prattencole. I'd never heard of it. It's certainly not a kind of bird you find in North America. But it was very common in the Ruaha, in the drier area that we went to. And it was just everywhere, and it was just the prettiest little new bird that we saw.
Excellent. We do want to move on to Ruaha. Anything else we should talk about in terms of the Serengeti experience before we leave that well-known park? More people.
There were so many more people compared to 9 years ago. And I know if you went to Rome or Paris, you'd be inundated with tourists also. But it brought out some bad behaviors by drivers and guests. People were going past the do not cross here signs and driving all the way down to the river's edge, which is against the rules. People were cutting people off because our guide was not behaving that way. We ended up far back from the action. There were just a lot of people. We were actually very relieved to go to the Ruaha because there it was just the opposite. It was so isolated and it's wide open spaces and almost no one in it. So that was nice.
Now you talk about the Ruaha as wide open spaces and I think of the Serengeti as wide open spaces. So the Ruaha is similar but drier?
Similar and drier. And like I said, there's less animals. You really have to look. And you also have to accept that you're not going to have that 2 foot away experience with the wildlife. Except that little prattencole that won't leave you alone, that little bird. But we liked it. It felt more of a real experience. The camp was very small. The first camp we stayed in, Quihala.
And when you say very small?
Maybe 8 tents.
Okay.
And again, we were in tents. And I have to say, one night, we'd seen a lion near camp, and we'd seen elephants near camp. And in the middle of the night, I was awakened by a roaring and then a trumpeting. And so in my mind, the lion roared and grabbed the baby elephant and the mother was trumpeting. That's what happened in my mind. I found out later that elephants make that roaring sound. Some people call it rumbling. It was so loud, but they make both sounds. So the elephant was bothered by something in the middle of the night, but nothing got killed. And they make this low, loud sound. And as I recall reading years ago, that low frequency sound carries like over miles. So it's very interesting. Mm-hmm.
So in terms of the two experiences, less people, fewer animals. Now, of course, you were also timing your trip to Serengeti when the Great Migration was there. I don't know if you had timed it differently if you'd seen more animals in the other park or if they get down that far. I'm just not.
No wildebeest I take that back. There's a different species of wildebeest that doesn't migrate, that just lives where it lives. Okay. I forget the name, but it was found in the Ruwah. And so we were in two camps. The first camp was wonderful and we saw lots of things. It had a river running through it, but at the time we were there, it was the dry season. And so the river was dry. And I might mention, birders often go to Africa during the wet season because that's when you see more birds. But people who go on safari tend to go during the dry season because you can see all the animals more easily. The grass is dead, brown.
Yeah, the other thing with the wet season, I've been in, if you go back and listen to the episode I did on Botswana, I was there when the dry season turned into the wet season, right? We were there for the first rain of the season and saw 100 elephants stampede by our camp. Stampede is a little strong, but they were running by our camp, running in the directions of the rain because they were so happy to see the rain. But also what happens then is all the bugs come out, all the termites. This is the season that they then mate when the rains come and dissolve the outer layer of the termite mounds. And so the flying ants and the termites and such come out. And the reason why the birds are there in the rainy season is there's more to eat. But the disadvantage of that is when you come out in the morning, if you turn on your light in your back of your tent, because we were mobile camping, then you're attracting all the bugs. And so that part was not quite as interesting. Wow. But yeah, you're getting a lot of birds. The birds literally fly down from Europe because there's so many bugs that it's a feast. So it's worth going for.
Yes, you really do have to, when you're picking a trip, look at when you are able to travel and what countries, what season you're going to hit. Obviously, to spend this amount of money, you want to go in a season that's optimal for what you want to see.
Right.
So I might mention in the second camp that we were in the Ruaha, the Usango camp, it had just opened. We have booked all four of our safaris through a company called ATR, which is Africa Travel Resource. Mm-hmm. And the guy who helps me plan the trips, he had been to this camp like the month it opened. And we were there like the second month it was open. It wasn't full to capacity when we were there. In fact, the first night, we were the only people there. We were definitely treated like royalty. But the really cool thing about this camp is they take a different slant on the safari experience. First, they have some of those newer tents in which one curved wall is all screen. And your eye, when you look through it, your eye focuses past the screen and it's almost like you're in the wide open. It's really beautiful. So instead of having all around you, except maybe one panel where you look out on your little outside section, these newer tents are really amazing. They're very beautiful to be in. But this camp also had a small research station there with a researcher who studies predators. Mm-hmm. On the vehicle, the first day we got there, we took two camera traps and set them up. Hmm. And a camera trap, you set it up near a dirt road. At least that's where we did. You could maybe have it near a lake or a river or wherever you think animals will be. And where we were, the animals make use of the dirt road because it's easier to walk on than making your way through a scrub forest. Mm-hmm. So we set up these camera traps, and what they do is they're motion activated. So when something walks by, it takes pictures. And so at the end of your stay, you go pick up your camera trap, take out the SIM card, put it in the computer, and you can see pictures of the animals that walk by in the night. So you see a lion walk by, you see a kudu walk by, you see a little mongoose shuffling by, you see a lion with a collar. walking by. It's really fascinating. I downloaded the pictures that it took over that 2-day period and kept them. The other thing that this camp did was they had night vision camera that was synced to the iPad, and they had an iPad sitting up facing us in the back seat on the first tier of seats. And so what he saw in the camera, we saw on the iPad. And it was really quite fun. They were learning the technology as we worked with them. My husband had experience in the night vision cameras. He was working with the guy on that. And it was really amazing what you could see without using a spotlight. So you're driving in the dark, mm-hmm. and you on the iPad get to see that basically the heat signatures of the animals. And my favorite picture, I took a picture of the iPad, was ahead of us, and we couldn't see it with our naked eye, were two ostrich sitting on the road. They like to sit on the road because it's warm at night. Mm-hmm. And so here in the night vision, we could see these two ostriches. Now, you only see where there's heat. So
right.
animals are covered with a lot of fur. You might just see parts of their face. With the ostrich, mm-hmm. you saw the neck and head because it's not covered with many feathers. And so the heat signature is picked up there.
And you say without the spotlight, and that's, of course, the normal thing is you're in the vehicle and your driver is basically playing across the savanna or whatever environment you're in with a great big spotlight, and that's how you're seeing things. And of course, that's a little disturbing for the animals too, but that's the typical experience. And what you're describing is not something I've experienced. That sounds interesting.
Oh, it was so amazing. My husband was talking about just getting a night vision camera, like to take on our next safari. We're techie people. I even thought I should get a camera trap for my backyard just to see the opossums and raccoons and the kind of urban wildlife that I see here at the beach. I might mention that when you go on safari, one of the questions you should find out about each park you go to is that parks have different rules. In the Serengeti, you are to be back in camp by sundown.
Right.
So you can't go out in the dark of night. I like going out at night because I find it fascinating to see what's out at night, right? Mm-hmm. And you can see those bat-eared foxes running around in pairs. And so we enjoyed the Ruaha because we could go out in the dark as well. I'm pretty sure in the last camp, the Nyahariri, we went out at night, not 4 in the morning, the evening part of the night. I like seeing that. So you see the day and then you get to see the night. Some camps that we've been in will cover their light with a red film. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't bother the animals' eyes as much, which right. I think is a prudent thing for them to do.
You mentioned when you go this far and have paid this much money, I want to talk just a little bit about cost, because the cost of a safari, I've done a great variety, some sponsored that would be outside of my price range, where I've done everything from, we did the amateur traveler trip, for instance, was 10 days and I don't know, it was $1,200 or something like that overland, including some park experiences like going to Kruger Park and things like that. And people can't see the Jane going, wow, with her lips here. So I've done that. And then also do the mobile safari, which is something like $300 a night. Or I've been in places where each individual night in this very posh camp is $1,000 to $2,000 per night. And so there is a range, and you get something obviously at different ranges. And when you fly versus drive, for instance, you save time and spend money. And any other in terms of tips for people in terms of when they're trying to price out what they're going to spend or making decisions about what makes sense, places where you were glad to spend the money. For instance, sounds like flying, that made sense.
We planned this last trip like money was no object. We did. It was our most expensive safari. I have a chronic back injury. And so for us, less of a long day driving from point A to point B, sure. which then lands me there aching. It's worth the fly. You know,
well, especially if part of that is off-road, that off-road driving and a bad back is not a good combination.
I actually found a very good position to sit in with my feet up on the bar in front of me and the camps. I have it written in my notes that I have a bad back. So they will put pillows out for me and I bring my own cushions that mm-hmm. work. And we've also found which kinds of vehicles work best. Sometimes I sit in one of the front seats because those are better. I'm kind of like Goldilocks. I just sit here and there until I can find the best possible seat. And the guides know that they try to jar me as little as possible. You can look at camps and the costs are different. Bigger camps mm-hmm. tend to be less expensive per person. We like little camps because mm-hmm. of the one-on-one you have with the guide. We have not gone with the bigger providers like Oat Travel. I know friends who've gone.
Okay.
Isn't that the right name? Overseas Adventure Travel. The only issue with going with a big group is that you'll be perhaps in the middle mm-hmm. of the vehicle and you're trying to take pictures and you just don't get as close to the animals. So
and you say the middle. So I don't think we've drawn this for people, but it typical safari vehicle can hold, say, 8 people. The driver, one other person in the front who's the lucky one, and then three behind them with one in the middle, and then three behind them up a little more, again, with one in the middle. And except for those two middle spots, all the rest are great.
But you're still maybe the lion's on the right and you're on the left.
That is true. If you only have 3 passengers in the vehicle, then the 2 people in the back can have the whole range of, they can go to the right or they go to the left as need be. Yep.
And if you're in a vehicle that's going to drive from, let's say, Arusha to the next park,
yep.
your vehicle tends to be more of a closed vehicle with like windows mm. that open. Mm-hmm. And by flying, you're put into these open vehicles. Often no roof. You're
yeah, that
totally
tends to,
open.
And that tends to depend on country too.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But I've been in the closed vehicle where there's a hole in the roof, but you've got solid walls around you in Tanzania, for instance. But in other countries, I've driven distances in these open vehicles. And then you have to remember to bring a bluff. So you've got this circle of fabric around you that you pull up over your nose and mouth to keep the dust out, you know, and you put your hat on with your string that keeps it from blowing off while you're going down the road. Or I think you said you used a tight ball cap, but I still swear by the cap with a string and a brim.
It's the kind of thing that if you're looking at a safari, mm-hmm. I would start making lists. I would have questions for the providers. What mm-hmm. are the vehicles like? What are the tents like? How many tents are in a camp? How many mm-hmm. people are in a camp? How many people will be in a vehicle? And
what,
all of
what
these.
What color I should not pack? Now, you had an interesting change there that I had not heard.
Not to wear navy blue or just any blue, because that's the color that the tsetse fly is attracted to. My first camp, there was a big, like, 5 feet by 5 feet, blue. I thought it was a flag. And it was hanging from this bush. And I said, dumb me, is that your flag? I didn't know what the Tanzanian flag looked like. And mm-hmm. he said, no, that flag-looking thing had been treated with insecticide. And it was blue to attract the tsetse fly to it. Mm. And then somehow it killed them. But yeah, we don't go in blue. We generally wear shades of kind of that camouflage green mm-hmm. and just sandy colored. Because if you wear something that's sand colored, then it doesn't show the dirt.
You're going to be wearing something that's sand colored anyway at the end.
Right. And I don't wear black either. Mm-hmm. They say don't wear bright colors. Don't wear a red shirt. Don't mm-hmm. wear a red and white flowered shirt. Wear muted colors. Plus, you're going to be going and you have to pack light. You have to generally, in those little planes, you have to put it in soft-sided bags.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to be wearing the same thing over and over. Wear something that's really bright. People will notice they saw it yesterday. But this last trip,
there
it turned
is something
out,
I have never worried about as much.
Well, I only had one heavy pair of pants, and it turned out every morning and every night was cold. And so I didn't let them wash my pants, because what would I wear tomorrow if they were washing my pants? So every night I just shook them out really hard and got the dust off of them and just thought, who cares? And wore them again the next day. Hmm. You also should look at the country, but some of the countries have a law against wearing camouflage that only the armed services can wear camouflage. I think that's in the Zambia and Zimbabwe. But before we went, I was obsessed with what to take. I Googled safari packing lists and found some good tips, and then made my own packing list, which now has worked for me for 4 different trips and some other more tropical safari-ish kinds of trips.
So. When we still have one more park that you've been to that we haven't talked about yet that I want to get to before we run out of time here.
Yes, and that's the old name Salu. It's a huge park. The new name is Nyerere. The only kind of odd thing in this park is that there were a lot of day trippers. People from Zanzibar book a day trip. So they fly over and then get in a vehicle and go on safari all day. And so you see these vehicles coming in mid-morning that don't look like they came from your camp, and that's who they are. I've just never been at a camp where there's a lot of day trippers, because normally you're so isolated. But this park was beautiful, the area we were in up in the north, in the Rojo Ya Salu camp, a combination between wet and dry areas. So you see a little bit of all sorts of animals. We really saw everything there. We had some wonderful encounters with elephants, watched a lion for a while until he just decided to take a nap under a tree, and then we got bored watching him sit. But we had a wonderful time there as well.
Anything specifically different about that camp except for besides the day trippers?
Just the diversity of habitats, because we came from the Ruaha, which was so dry. I thought we in Southern California were dry, but it's very dry. And it's a thorny scrub that the giraffes eat. It's an interesting environment I'd never been in. Just kind of almost forbidding, with these thorn bushes everywhere. And then the Nyerere was much more lush and more animals. Whenever you have that mix of aquatic and terrestrial environments, you get more animals. So it was lovely. It was our last camp. But the camps, everyone there loves to make you happy. It was my birthday that week. And out in the Ruaha, they baked me a birthday cake. And then on the next day, we went to the last camp and they all sang happy birthday to me. Just all these little wonderful moments that you have while you're on safari, getting to know your guides. We had one guide who was a Maasai, and they are legally allowed to have more than one wife. So we asked him, how do you do that? How's it all work out for you? And he told us very candidly how he came to have two wives, which sounded more like a story from here than the wilds of Africa. But it was a wonderful trip. I came home with thousands of pictures. I had a new camera, and so I had loads of fun taking lots of pictures. Just busy every day. Got to see so much.
Well, when we say busy every day, we drew a little bit of a picture of the day, but what I'm picturing is you get up before dawn. It's cold, as you said. You go out when it's still dark, and then you stay out for at least 3 hours. I think you were staying out for longer than that.
Oh, only because I push and ask for more time.
And then you typically go back to camp and read your book or have a siesta or whatever, and then go out again late in the afternoon and have your sundowner drink by sunset, and then come back. You're saying a lot of places don't want you out much past dark. So it depends on where you are, whether you go out again later but that's what your experience was?
Absolutely. And I will say, often at the midday siesta time, my husband would take a nap. And interestingly, I did something then I never normally did. Typically, I would read a book then. I'm not much of a napper. Every camp we went to had Wi-Fi, which
that surprised me.
Blew me away. And it cost them a lot of money. And of course, it's slow, but it was enough for me to put little picture collages on Facebook once or twice a day and check my emails. But they said that the camps, it was hard. First of all, the camps were closed for a while, but then the Europeans started traveling and travelers within Africa started traveling. So the camps opened a while ago. And there was a lot of isolation for the staff. And so we were told that the development of Wi-Fi at all of the camps we were at was as much for the people who were isolated there in the camps, because you may work at a camp for months at a time.
Right.
So that was kind of a surprise. Now, don't bet on that at any camp you go. And I think guests certainly like it to be connected to some degree.
Some do and some don't. Some appreciate the forced isolation. I'm sorry, I couldn't check my emails, boss, but some of us really do like our connectivity.
And it wasn't everywhere. In Usangu, it was up at the research station. So I'd go sit up there and do some things. But still, when you're doing what they call bush TV, which means staring at the fire, at the campfire at night, you don't have everyone sitting and staring at their device like we often do at every other get-together. People are there talking to each other. You get to know people from other countries. We just had made some fast friends, quick friends, right? You have a breakfast with someone and by afternoon you're airdropping pictures back and forth. It's neat to meet the other people that you see in the camps that are just from everywhere.
Excellent. As we head towards wrapping this up, Jane, anything else people need to know before they go to Tanzania? Specifically.
Oh, here's one. They have outlawed plastic bags.
Okay.
And normally I take snacks for vacation. I just like to have some dried nuts and that sort of thing. And of course you have to check the country to see if you can bring in snacks. I always just Google what the restrictions are for any country we go into. But my thing then was, how do I bring in some almonds if I can't bring in a plastic baggie? So I use at home the reusable kind, the real thick ones that have, they just wash out and then you reuse. So I use those, but I didn't know if they'd look through our bags, but on the airplane, they said, do not be seen carrying a grocery bag of any kind. But I made sure nothing was even in our bags in a baggie of any kind. So that was an interesting thing. They have told us that they're going to outlaw plastic bottles in the country.
Yeah, that's a big problem in many places.
Yes. But I noticed that when we were in Arusha, which is a big town, nothing like Dar, but it's big, there were not the strewn plastic bags all over the countryside that you see everywhere else on Earth. So that decision has made a noticeable difference in the trash that you didn't see.
Excellent. As we wrap this up, you are standing in the prettiest spot in Tanzania. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
I think it was a time we were by this little creek and there was a leopard in the tree and there was just our vehicle. So there weren't a line of cars looking at it. And it's just the green of the tree and the beautiful spots of the leopard and just behind rolling hills as far as you can see of that kind of golden grass. It was just a magic moment. And that leopard just stayed there and we didn't radio anyone else to tell them to come. We just sat and enjoyed the moment with this animal that was so beautiful.
Excellent. Bonus question, 160 birds, favorite three.
Oh gosh. The Pratt and Cole was my new
New favorite.
Favorite yep, bird, yep. And I'll send you a picture of that. I love the bee eaters. If bee you don't know what a bee eater, yeah. They're like a rotund hummingbird, and they eat bees. They're very quick, mm-hmm. And there's different species, and they're all beautiful. And mm-hmm. The roller is found through southern Africa, and it's mm-hmm. beautiful, and it has this mating thing where it rolls through the air, flies up high, and rolls down. I've only seen that once.
I have not seen it.
Beautiful bird.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Tanzania.
When you say, how long till we get back to camp? And they say, 20 minutes. And an hour and 40 minutes later, you're rolling into camp.
Little different sense of time.
Yeah, okay. That's okay.
And if you had to summarize Tanzania, especially a safari experience in Tanzania, in three words, what three words would you say?
Beauty, mm-hmm. wildlife, and relaxing.
Excellent.
It's a very relaxing vacation.
Our guest again has been Jane Horlings. And Jane, thank you so much for coming on back on Amateur Travel. I say back on Amateur Travel because we have to record this one twice. I feel like I've been saying that a lot recently, but we've had some technical problems. And thank you for your patience with that. And thank you for sharing with us your love for Tanzania.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to thank the patrons of Amateur Traveler who help support the show financially. Just got off the monthly Zoom call with some of the patrons of the show. Always a good time. Some of them much more widely traveled than I am, so I always enjoy it. If you're interested in supporting Amateur Traveler because you've had a great trip because Amateur Traveler helped, go to patreon.com/amateurtraveler and learn more. This is an episode I don't talk about it all the time, but remember every episode of the Amateur Traveler, every new episode, not some of the repeats that come out, have chapters and links in them. So that you can see what it is we're talking about, but you have to be using one of the podcast players that works to show those. So for instance, on the iPhone, I use Downcast, which will show you all of the pictures. This is a great episode to take advantage of that feature to see all the different animals we're talking about, including that close encounter with lions that we heard about. If you don't have that particular version of a podcast player, so you're not seeing the pictures, then I will put that picture of the close encounter of the lion in the show notes also at amateurtraveler.com because I don't want people to miss out on that. And then the other reminder on pictures and links on chapters is that they're only in the show for sure, guaranteed for the first month that it comes out or in the Patreon version forever, because once I do inserted ads, which I do in the older episodes, that unfortunately conflicts. And so just remember to always subscribe and download the episodes when they come out. I am back from a TBEX, a travel blog exchange conference, a travel blogging conference in Thailand. Had a great time. Did pick up COVID in the process. So fortunately, a mild case. All those boosters that I got seem to have worked out. And I'm on antivirals right now, which I feel fine with those, although they leave a terrible taste in my mouth. I don't know what that's all about. But I'm on the mend, and hopefully we'll continue to crank out these episodes of Amateur Traveler. If you have a story for Amateur Traveler, as Jane did, who is a listener of the show, send me an email to host@amateurtraveler.com and pitch me. Pitch me why we should have you come on the show and talk about that destination. For more information, go to amateurtraveler.com/pitch.me to learn what I'm looking for. And with that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should